please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Wheelock, Judge Schmidt. The Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. And welcome to the Court of Appeals. I believe we're in a cool January 18 date. We have three matters on our oral calendar today. I'll remind counsel that we are recording the proceedings while we're live streaming and recording. We do ask for that reason that you do identify yourself for the record when you begin your comments and who you represent. There is a clock, of course, at the podium on the right side, I believe, and there's also a button somewhere on the face if you want to adjust the height to your comfort as well before you begin. The first case is A23-1209, Craig Stevenson et al., appellants versus Sean Stevenson et al., respondents. And so when counsel for appellants ready, you may approach and identify yourself and then begin. I knew it was there somewhere. I too can't remember.
It just took a moment to find it.
Begin when you're ready, counsel.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Cassandra Wolfgram, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellants, Craig and Marie Stevenson, along with co-counsel Matthew Scopp. This court is an error-correcting court. As an error-correcting court, this court is mandated to decide cases consistent with the existing law and cannot issue decisions contrary to the established Supreme Court precedent. When a district court issues an order contrary to this law, this court must step in and reverse. Today we have two issues primarily before the court. The first is summary judgment. We have a summary judgment order that was issued contrary to fact, contrary to law. Specifically, it failed to address genuine issues of material fact which were in dispute and misapplied the prevailing law and did not apply prevailing law. Second, we have pretrial orders.
Second, counsel, can I ask you on the first, I did see the brief was replete with those statements about the judge not following the law. I'm going to quiz you a little bit more on that, and I'm focused specifically, the Long Bean case reiterated some case law that when you're talking about defamation per se, that it is the role, it's a judicial decision, a judge decision as to whether particular words are actionable. And so when you combine that with the fact that under the standard of review that's also cited in your brief, much is made of the McKee phraseology of culpable or capable, I can't remember the phrase, the words that are uttered. But in this case, the key question precedes that is, are the words that uttered alleging a crime, which then we go back to that standard, that's the per se, which becomes a legal determination as to whether the case can move forward. So as I read the judge's order, that's essentially exactly what the judge did, took all the statements we all know about, which are really indisputed, I mean, what the words, the sources of the words, and looked at each one of those and made that judicial determination. So isn't that, as a matter of law, what the judge was supposed to do?
It was not, Your Honor, and that's because the law is very clear, and this starts with Larson, and then we've got Anderson and Longbend, that if the words can construe or impute criminal activity, then it is defamatory per se, and if it can be understood as imputing criminal activity, it has to go to the jury. Now, the judge went, and the district court decided that it had to go through and determine whether all of the elements of criminal activity were met. So for theft, were all the elements of theft met? And that's not what the case law requires. It goes off of defamatory per se as this reasonable person standard. And so would a reasonable person understand this as imputing criminal activity?
But can I just follow up? The can impute, isn't that the part about the legal determination? In other words, we all know the standard, if there are genuine issues of material fact, and the judge at least articulated that he understood that as well. But again, we're kind of a step before that in the sense that in the per se, and the case law is replete with language that innuendo cannot enhance a meaning. And so it's undisputed here, I believe, other than the word theft, perhaps, or stolen, that none of the words themselves, and we know, again, that's not fatal in and of itself, but then we know innuendo also cannot expand that. So isn't that what the judge was doing here, is whether under the circumstances of we're concerned about Maria, I believe it is, whether that is an accusation of because he's a wife beater or something like that, which we didn't have.
Your Honor, we have to go back to that you have to consider the context. And so the cases have been clear that, you know, something might not be defamatory on its face, but when you consider all the context around it and the content, then it is. And so we have in this situation that Sean made these allegations that Craig had moved all his possessions out of the house, secretly put his name on the fire insurance, was stealing from Rennie, and Rennie was afraid for her life and believed he was going to murder us. You put that in context, and the implication is that Craig had a plan to burn down the house and kill them inside of it. So these conversations about Marie are after this same conversation. So when we're talking about the safety of Marie, we're concerned about Marie, it's already in Craig and Marie's mind and their daughter's mind that we're talking about Craig thought had a plan to murder them and burn them alive in the house. And that's why they're scared. And so we can't just take that and separate it from everything else that's happening around it.
I don't recall seeing any statements about burning down the house. Is that in your brief or is that in?
It is in the actual statements. And so
I don't see it as being alleged as defamatory per se. I saw that you talked about murdering, about safety, about what he might do to Marie.
Yes. So we didn't say that specific statement was defamatory per se. So it's included in Addendum 116. That's the July 7, 2019 email. And so what it says is the paragraph right before, my mother was already afraid for her life because knowing you, she thought you quite capable of murdering us both. Right before that, it says, Craig had moved every single one of his possessions and all of her money out of the house, moved the bed from the bedroom to right next to the door to the outside of the house, and Craig had secretly put his name on the fire insurance for the house, even though my mother bought it and it was in her name. The next sentence is, Rennie was afraid for her life and thought you quite capable of murder. You put those together, that implication is Craig was planning to burn down the house with us inside of it.
But the specific allegation you're raising about defamatory per se is the capable of murdering.
Correct.
Right?
And,
okay.
And the rules are that you have to not just consider the statement in isolation. We can't just take that one sentence out and ignore everything else that's in the same email, because that's the content and the context of this statement. And it goes back to a statement might not be defamatory on its face, but when read in context with everything else around it, then it becomes defamatory. So you have to consider everything and not just separate it out and parse it from the rest of the email that's in here.
It feels like, at least to me, I'm not speaking for the panel, that feels like a new argument that I don't see in your brief, that it's this idea of that he was moving towards murder or had a plan because of this fire and the insurance policy and what he did with moving things around the house.
And we did have that in there in our brief. We specifically said that, you know, this is, the facts are that Marie, they're alleging, Marie was scared for her life. Rennie was scared because he had abused and had a plan to murder us, and he'd moved everything out. And so it's reading it in context, where, like I said, we didn't allege putting the fire insurance was a defamatory statement of itself. It's context for that statement that Craig had a plan to murder us.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
Part of Judge Smith's question, your answer to it, the capable of murder quote, in your client's complaint, the allegation of crime nowhere mentions murder. Am I correct about that?
Correct. The crimes
that we've... It mentions domestic abuse, false imprisonment, and I think one of the counts with Renee, I think you pronounced
yes.
her name? Thank you, was the theft. And so I was kind of curious when I saw the summary judgment order and I kind of went back and then I see the briefing, there's a lot of talk about capable of murder and yet murder wasn't one of the crimes alleged. So I somewhat took from that that it was perhaps a factual argument of circumstantial allegation to support the domestic abuse.
And so...
And of course the words are capable of murder and the word attempt to murder wasn't in the complaint obviously yeah. either. Am I wrong about that?
It all comes in... No, you're correct, Your Honor. It all comes in together because...
But what's the crime? Maybe I should just ask you this. What are the crimes that your client alleges were the defamatory per se crimes that were
specifically
stated.
Rennie and Sean alleged theft, domestic assault, and they alleged those and then like imputed this that he's capable of murder, which is a huge crime because of the fact he's done all these other items that were all disputed.
So is the allegation imputing both murder and domestic abuse, or is it I mean, the judge seemed to take it that way because the judge focused
yeah.
on that, but under the category of domestic abuse, discussed that email in particular, capable of murder, but I'm just trying to understand where murder fits into this per se.
So the children understood this to accuse Craig of being a murderer and that he was assaultive and threatening, that he was dangerous to them and could harm them.
Now, that wouldn't be relevant, though, would it? To the judge's analysis or ours, the question of whether objective, reasonable. I just wanted to make sure your client is alleging murder to be one of the crimes, though it wasn't in the complaint or defamation per se.
I believe that it was still cited in there that was one of the defamatory statements, was alleging the murder.
Attempt murder?
That he was quite capable of murder and had a plan to murder us all.
Was the judge incorrect, in your opinion, that being capable of committing a crime isn't the same as alleging someone committed a crime under the per se defamation law?
Well, they can be different, but that goes back to the context. Just saying somebody's capable of something may not be defamatory in and of itself, but then you put in, here's our factual basis as to why he was doing this. That changes the content and the context of it, and it creates it that it's a factual assertion. He had this plan. So it's not just he was capable of it. He literally, Sean's allegation is there was a plan to murder us.
Without the words, there is a plan.
Well, he said, I hoped he hadn't planned. But that's really a couching the argument as an opinion, which you can't do. You can't just use the words, I hope he didn't, to change the connotation of the statement. The statement was to imply Craig was a murderer. And that was the exact implication that came off and how Michaela and Miranda understood it, how Craig understood it, how Marie understood it. Everybody got the same understanding that Craig is a murderer because no matter how you phrase it, you hear the words, Craig is a murderer.
No, wasn't it more just capable of or planned to? That's different than saying someone's a murderer.
Well, you hear this, he had already had stolen from us, moved his stuff out, put his name on the fire insurance, and he had planned to murder us. You hear that, and you hear Craig had a plan to kill us by fire.
But that's not saying that he actually killed somebody.
It's not saying it, but it's imputing it. That's the imputation. You've got the alleging or imputing criminal activity. Nobody has a plan to murder somebody without having criminal activity.
So, but let me I just want to go back to something you said earlier. The two crimes that we're looking at are theft and domestic assault.
Those were the very specific ones, yes.
Okay, so that's what we should limit our analysis to, is these two crimes are these various statements in context defamatory per se?
We can't just ignore the words that there's murder there, because that very clearly imputes criminal activity.
Okay. So theft, domestic assault, and murder?
Yes.
Are those the three crimes then that
yeah.
we should? Okay.
Your brief reference, false imprisonment, is that off the table then?
Yes, I did forget that one. That one's on Rennie, so I was thinking specifically on Sean at that point. But Sean's emails and Rennie's emails are separate. So Rennie was alleging the false imprisonment, which
once again, was understood.
Go back to the answer to Judge Schmidt's question. I think your answer was alleging someone's capable of committing a crime imputes that they committed the crime. Is that what you said? And if so, is there any law that would support that statement to equal defamation per se by alleging a crime?
Well, Your Honor, I'd go back to Longbin that you can't. Longbin, you know, they said you can't call anybody.
It was a pedophile.
Yes, you can't say somebody's a pedophile and see that that's anything but defamatory. You can't be going and telling people, so this person had a plan to murder us and understand that as anything other than defamatory.
Well, wouldn't the equation, though, be then he's a murderer, like a pedophile? That would, a reasonable person would say, well, then he committed murder. But being capable of being a pedophile or being capable, I suppose, of domestic assault or capable of theft doesn't mean I've done any one of those or a person has, right?
Your Honor, yeah, we've gone over that we can't just couch statements to make it into an opinion or saying he's capable of it to ignore the actual connotation behind it. The purpose is the same. It's to make this implication that Craig was a murderer. And, you know, but this has been discussed in Milkovich.
Everybody knew that the people were still alive, right? And so he can't be a murderer if the people he's talking about are living. It might be a plan to murder. It might be capable of murdering, but it's not murderer.
Yes, they were still murderer. They were still alive. But anyone being called a murderer is very damaging. Like, there's the two worst crimes to most people, the most heinous, would be being a pedophile and being a murderer. And so just recouching it to say he's capable of it, or I thought he planned to, doesn't avoid the liability. I mean, and we can go back to McKee that this is, was it reasonably interpreted as stating a fact? And it was. It's not an opinion. It's a fact. And he was not a murderer. And so you're still implying that he's a criminal by making this statement. And, Your Honor, I realize I'm out of time.
Very well. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal as well. Counsel for respondent, you may approach and identify yourself and then begin.
I think I might be grateful that we're both about the same height. I wasn't going to say short. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kirsten Hansen. I am here today with Ross Tettinger. We represent the respondents in this matter. We are asking that this court affirm the district court's well-reasoned opinion in summary judgment in this matter. The district court did follow the law and acted as it was supposed to in a gatekeeping capacity. We are also asking that the court affirm the district court's various decisions with regard to discovery, sanctions, and a motion for reconsideration.
I actually have a question about that. Do we have to reach those issues if we affirm on the summary judgment?
No, you don't, Your Honor. This, I think the court has already understood, is a reasonably straightforward case. Plaintiffs actually claimed this out in two of the, as, I mean, other than the conspiracy theories, which I'll leave to one side, but as a defamation per se and intentional infliction of emotional distress. With regard to defamation per se, they have to take that next step. They have to show that, in this case, Sean or Reenie was accusing, in that case, Craig, of an actual crime. And the courts are very specific that it doesn't actually have to be, you can't use implication. You can't use innuendo. And that's Maradas versus Odegaard, which is a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1943. What it basically says is that you have to take these statements as...
Hansen, could I ask you about that?
Sure.
Would you agree there's a distinction between innuendo and implied? The innuendo, the law is pretty clear, but on the other hand, many of these cases are implied. In fact, Pat the pedophile implies pretty strongly, but it still implies and imputes. Would you agree that the law would allow implied criminal allegation or allegation of a crime?
I won't say no, but I'm going to hedge on that one. I think if it is an implication type claim, it has to be so clear that it is inescapable. Pat the pedophile. You can't be a pedophile unless you've actually committed pedophilia. If you accuse somebody of murder, you actually have to have murdered somebody. There's got to be a corpse. Just saying, I think somebody could be a pedophile, while not flattering, is not a claim that they actually are. Likewise, saying, hate to use this, but sometimes in the vernacular you hear, I was so mad I could just kill that person. Well, that doesn't make that person a murderer. There's no implication there. So yes, I would agree with the court that implication is broad enough that it can apply in some ways, but it's got to be so clear as to be inescapable. And that's what you don't have here. What you have here is an unfortunate family feud that began with the first marriage that fell apart. I don't think there's any disagreement amongst the parties that the marriage between Renee and Craig was troubled. It didn't end well. It was involved in a lot of post-divorce litigation. There was a lot of accusations, and some of which, by the way, Craig does agree to.
Can I ask about that on the theft allegation or claim? The judge granted summary judgment principally on the legal status of husband and wife, and one cannot be accused of stealing from another if it's marital property presumed to be joint by both. I noticed neither party, and particularly your, addressed that as a basis for affirming. Can you tell me why you didn't argue that or follow that same reasoning?
Well, in one case, just because I thought the court put it out so well, I didn't need to pound it into the ground with my limited amount of words. Also, I think I wanted to focus on some additional arguments on top of that. So we'll just take the stolen from. A, I want the court to look at the Schmidt versus Witherick matter, which says even like a literal statement of a crime is not defamatory if a reasonable listener would understand that this is figuratively. He stole things from Renee. Well, there's no dispute that Craig, when he left the marital home, he admits to this, that he took items that belonged to Renee prior to marriage. Those are the silver certificates, which he never had a claim to, and a coin collection, which he claims he added some coins to. There's also other items that are in the divorce decree that he took and were required to return, but the court focused on the silver certificates and this coin collection. When Sean says she was stolen from, I think, A, she actually was. If you look at what actually happened, Craig literally did take items away from Renee that he knew he had no right to have, took them away, and didn't give them back until he was asked to. Now, if I gave it back later was a defense to stealing, nobody'd be in jail. You know, hey, we caught you stealing these sneakers. Oh, well, you can have them back now. I mean, that's not the way it works. He took it with the intent. Now, there was an argument originally in the underlying that he had a right to take the coin collection, that he had commingled some of his coins with hers. He was just taking it to, you know, sort those out. But as the district court correctly notes, he never had a claim to these silver certificates. He took them. They were her property that she brought into the marriage. He never claimed, oh, by the way, I bought them for her or I had some claim to it. He literally took rare silver certificates and walked off with them. That's theft. He might not think it's theft. He might think, oh, well, you know, I just grabbed it accidentally. He doesn't even say he grabbed it accidentally. He just says, I took it, but I gave it back later. Well, that doesn't take away the theft.
Isn't that disputed, though, in terms of, well, it was they're married, they're getting divorced, he's taking some of the things out of the house, and it all has to be sorted out later. And so if we're looking at that reasonable person understand standard, wouldn't that be a fact question for the jury?
Actually, it's not, Your Honor, because of the testimony of Craig himself. Craig himself testified that when he took the coins, which can take the coins first, that he knew he was taking Renee's coins that she brought into the marriage. Okay, so that he knew it wasn't joint marital property. He has an explanation. I think the court does a good job of explaining why he doesn't meet, you know, it's joint marital property. But the court also, again, talks about the silver certificates. Again, those are silver certificates that are brought in to the marriage by Renee, to which Craig never had a claim. There is, under no circumstance could he ever say, this was mine and I'm entitled to it, you know, as a part of the divorce. It was never marital property.
Well, then we're reading into the phrase betrayed and stolen from. We're saying stole silver certificates.
Right.
And the phrase is much more broad than that, where it could be stolen from. It could be lots of different.
I'm not sure I'm understanding.
Well, my question is, that, you know, it's a very broad phrase that could be interpreted in a lot of different ways. And we're focused on a certificate here, and we're not. That's not what was alleged to have been. That's not what was said.
What was said was she was stolen from.
Mm.
And that is broad, and I think that's actually why I focused more on the Schmidt versus Warnick. If you take a broad claim like stolen, there's no specific crime alleged. It's like, you know, when you can't find the remote, oh, somebody stole it. Nobody stole it. You can't find it. Stolen, we are focusing, like you said, on the silver certificates and the coins, could mean a lot of things. Stolen her hope for life. Stolen her dreams to have a happy family. It's in relationship, the whole statement that they claim is defamatory says that the only time he ever saw his mother crying was when she thought about her past and how she was stolen from by somebody she loved. Now, Craig is himself says, oh, it's because I took the silver certificates and the coins. That's obviously what she's talking about. This is a woman who was married. She had an infant son, and her husband left. A lot of things were stolen from her, not just silver certificates and coins. I'd also like to point out that the other claims that made against Sean are, again, as you pointed out, not actually claims of crimes. It's sort of this implication in the broadest sense to make it innuendo. I'm looking at my time, so I'm trying to race through.
Can I ask you, it looks like from your brief you agreed with appellant's counsel that one of the allegations, the criminal allegations, is murder.
Well,
and because you're arguing why the judge got it right, that but the judge put it under the category of domestic abuse, I believe, which is the claim in the complaint. But everybody seems to be focused on that statement as whether it is or not an allegation of murder. So does your client agree that's one of the crimes alleged?
No, and that might be a mistake on my briefing. I took what they did and responded in accordingly. But if you read what the district court says, is what they're saying is this is some sort of allegation of domestic abuse. But again, I'm going to hedge my bets and say it goes two ways on that one. It never actually says either one. Being claimed to be able to murder somebody is neither an accusation of, and then he beat me, which is domestic abuse, or then he killed me, which is a claim of murder. So it doesn't fit either one. So I'm trying to maybe be a little too vague for the court's liking, but that's how I'm hitting it.
Would you agree that by the Longbean standard, the judge did seem to focus a fair amount on jury instructions and definitions and elements, and there's case law that would support that and perhaps in the right circumstance, but as we already know from in the statements you just made, would you agree that those statements, if those were the ones written, would satisfy the Longbean standard to be defamatory per se?
No.
If you said, if someone said he's a white beater.
Oh, well, I'm sorry.
I was referring to, you gave a couple there of what it wasn't.
Yeah, if it said, Craig is a wife beater, then that has to imply that he did, in fact, beat a wife. That's the pedophile. Craig is a murderer. There's got to be a body someplace that he he killed. Craig is a bank robber. He has to have robbed a bank. I think that he might be able to do so is not a crime. So I hope that clarifies.
Well, just to be clear, one can accuse someone, that's the issue, fact issue for trial, whether it's true or not, right? So we don't need a body or a bank, but it needs to be a crime alleged. Is that the point you're making?
Yes, that'd be true. I mean, if in fact the statement was, we'll just say, Sean had said, and Craig beat the tar out of my mother, then I think there would be now this fact question to, did Craig actually beat the tar out of his mother? And is that defamatory? So you would hit, that would be where you would hit the level of question of fact. When there's a statement that is, now you have to decide if that's true or not. Did Craig actually beat Reaney? And that's what you don't have here. I do want to briefly address the Reaney to Miranda letter. That's the letter with the claim to false imprisonment. It's the only one we really haven't touched on crimes. There's a couple major arguments on that one. First of all, it's a self-published statement. Craig found it in the spam filter, read it, printed it out, and gave it to his daughter. They have never made a defense of a requirement for self-publication, so if it's self-published, it can't be defamatory. Second, if you actually look at the language, it's actually not claiming false imprisonment is what they're claiming. So false imprisonment, the person has to want to leave and is prevented from leaving through force or coercion. In this case, actually, everybody agrees that Miranda doesn't want to leave. It's a criticism of Craig's child rearing. She's saying, you raised your kid to never want to leave the house. You didn't give her the tools to want to leave the house. That is not, and she's been desperately trying to escape out the front door and you've locked it, which is what they're interpreting this to be. There's no actual claim of a crime. In fact, everybody agrees that Miranda doesn't want to leave. It's that the argument is by Reaney, she's saying, you never gave your daughter the tools to be an adult, to be independent. And that is not a crime. And so I think under both of those, I think first, self-publication is just, it's just out. You can't publicize, I'll get that word out. You can't self-publicize and then say, oh, look, I was defamed. So that, and they've, I'm out of time.
You can finish up if you want, briefly.
Thank you. And they've never made the claim that they were required to self-publicize. So I think that's just out as a basis. Thank you.
Thank you. And counsel for appellant, you'll now have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to address some of the statements that were made by counsel for the respondents. First, we object to the statements by a counsel of their personal opinion. I would remind that this court does a de novo review on summary judgment. Counsel's personal opinion is not relevant to any of these issues at hand. Second, I want to quickly address the self-publication. Your Honor, this is a red herring. This article, the email from Rennie to Miranda, was published to Sean and to Ashley. The proof of that is in Addendum 118, where Rennie forwarded it to Sean the same day. Sean forwarded it to Ashley the same day. They keep talking about this self-publication, but they published it to themselves and to additional people. Your Honor, and then we talk about, counsel discussed that Miranda doesn't want to leave. And I want to just focus on this a little bit. There's been a lot of discussion about substantial truth and opinion. If Miranda didn't want to leave, wanted to leave, and Craig wasn't allowing her to leave, then that would meet all the elements for false imprisonment, and the statement wouldn't be defamatory because it's true. But because Miranda doesn't want to leave, but the email clearly implies that she's being forced to stay at home by her dad and doesn't have the ability to leave, they're saying that still isn't defamatory because she doesn't want to leave. This is creating the problem. Defamation is this implication of a false activity. They have implied criminal activity, false imprisonment. They cannot get around it by saying, oh, well, she doesn't want to leave, so it's not really false imprisonment. It's not, you have to consider everything in context. And the way they're phrasing this, it would completely get rid of the defamation law entirely and give defendants free rein to also, say anything they want.
Can I ask you, what is your understanding of innuendo? Because and I was asking Ms. Hansen about that too, there's a distinction. A lot of that seems to be innuendo, perhaps strong innuendo, but we have the case law that innuendo cannot expand the words to then imply or impute a crime.
Your Honor, the case law provides that you have to consider it in context. So these are the words of the same email. It's not innuendo in that email. It's saying, for example, one of the statements is that co-counsel was raising was, oh, I just feel like somebody could have killed that person. Well, if you're saying just that, you know, say you just had a bad day and you're mad at that person, and then you go and say, well, this day they said this, this day they said this, this day they said this, then you're bringing that all together to say, oh, no, they really mean it. That's innuendo. You're taking all this other extraneous information to prove what that statement is. You're not using the actual words of the statement to understand that single sentence, which is what we have here. We have the words in the statement clearly making the clear implication that Miranda can't leave the house because Craig won't let her.
How does that compare to the sentence, even if you wanted to leave? Which it doesn't add strong innuendo that she doesn't want to leave.
Well,
and if she doesn't want to leave, how can it be a crime?
Well, it says that Craig won't give her any of the ability to leave, that Craig can't let her leave the house, won't give her the means to do so. And it implies, when you read it, that she can't have a thought without daddy's permission, that she's not allowed to do anything. And she's being coerced, especially with the statement of quit lying to your children to keep them in the house, by Craig to stay in the house and stay with him. And that all implies that she's being imprisoned by him. Your Honor, I wanted to just briefly, I know I don't have a lot of time, but there was a quick comment about stolen could be dreams or life. You know, that doesn't mean criminal allegation. Stole connotates theft. Take does not. But additionally, this allegation that it could have been dreams or life was not raised at any point in the district court, the trial court, or even before today. And so that this court should not be considering that.
Counsel, I'd like to ask the same question I asked of your opposing counsel earlier. If we were to affirm, and I'm not saying we are, but if we were, do we need to address the discovery issues?
Your Honor, the case law is pretty clear that if you affirm on summary judgment, pretrial issues become moot. But, you know, it's also important to realize exactly how extensive this discovery issues were, that even today, after this appeal was filed, we found out more documents and evidence were in the defendant's possession, which weren't produced to us, including the names of 12 witnesses. And so we were entirely precluded from being able to present a case because they unilaterally controlled the scope of discovery contrary to the rules of evidence and the rules of civil procedure. And, Your Honor, could I just quick one sentence?
And I have one more question on that before, if I may.
Yes, certainly.
The sanctions piece of that would survive, even if we were to affirm on the summary judgment side, right? Like the idea of the sanctions were not enough or that sort of thing. Like that would
be separate from the other pretrial issues, yes.
Okay.
So, Your Honors, we've got lots of issues before us. As this court is an error-correcting court, it has to review the record and control and issue a decision in accordance with the law. The law today requires reversal and remand. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your briefing as well as answers to our questions today. We will now take the matter under advisement. We'll be issuing a ruling within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Have a good day and try to stay warm.
Thank you.